So today, I'm going to take up a koan right near the end of the Hekigan Roku. As you know, the Hekigan Roku is probably the single most famous book in Zen Buddhism. The translation of the words means the Blue Cliff Record. And it is a collection of 100 koan. It actually predates the Mumon Koan. But it's held back in most schools of Zen where koans are studied until after the student has completed all the koan, the 48 koan and the Mumon Koan. Because these koan, I think they even go, many of them, somewhat deeper. Some of them are very abstruse, very difficult. The one we're going to bring up is not. It's very plain and straightforward. But has a profound meaning that after we take it up, I think you'll agree with me, is something at the very start of every period of Zazen. You should momentarily consider the deep meaning of this koan so that you can actually practice Zazen. Now, this koan deals with cause and effect or karma. And it's interesting because it's the 97th koan. It's right at the end of the Hekigan Roku, which is near the end of the formal training of a Zen student, at least in this school that was initiated by Philip Kaplow. When I worked with Richard, I actually went beyond this. There were several other collections we looked at. But this was thought when we finally completed the 100th koan in the Hekigan Roku to be the completion of, let's say, my basic training in Zen. Now, the second koan in the Mumon Koan, almost like bookends, deals with this same issue, the one about Hyakujo's fox. So these two are kind of bookends of the curriculum of koan that in our particular school are considered the fundamental two collections that we work with as Zen students. Now, before we bring this koan up, I think it would be very useful as an entry into it to have you hear a story that I'll tell you about. It's very current. You all know that my mother died 4 days ago. My mother and Rick, who is here, his mother, Dina. She died at age 88. And I thought I would tell you just a little bit, a thumbnail about who she was, what her background was, and what happened to her. And then maybe we can put it in the context of this beautiful 97th koan in the Hekigan Roku. So, Dina was born in 1926 in Marrakesh, Morocco. And she was the second to youngest of nine siblings. Brought up in a traditional Orthodox Jewish household, they were Sephardic, meaning the origins of their lineage was from southern Spain. And there were many Jews living in Morocco at the time, but they were still kind of outsiders in the culture there and never felt totally at home. And in fact, none of my family is left in Morocco. They've all scattered either to the United States, Canada, Israel, and maybe some other places, France. But my mother grew up there in the 1920s and 30s. And she was a unique person, like we all are. Beautiful. Very intense. A live wire. A hot ticket, you could call her. She was full of piss and vinegar. In particular, she was able to stand up to her oldest brother, Moses, who was the taskmaster and the head of the household. Her father, Joseph, was more passive and retiring. He was very much almost like a rabbi or a Sufi master. I saw a picture of him yesterday at the funeral. My brother showed me a picture of Joseph. He had a long beard. He was wearing a robe. This was probably from back in the 1910s, 1920s. But his oldest son, as was tradition, was the taskmaster, and he was brutal. And as a result, and because my mother was so outspoken and stood up to him, where all of her other siblings didn't, were afraid of him, but she wasn't, at age 20, she decided to leave her family and come to the so-called New World, come to America, which she did. She was actually the second of the siblings to do. The first one was her younger sister, Frances, who came first, and then Frances invited her to come over as well. So at age 20, my mother, Dina, got on the Queen Mary by herself and sailed to Boston. Getting off the boat, looking around and being extremely puzzled. Where were all the horses and cowboys? This is what she knew of America, just from westerns that she had seen in Morocco back in the 1920s and 30s. So it was rather a surprise to see cars and traffic and noise and a very, very modern society, which she immediately attempted to adapt to, jump in with both feet, shed her old skin, so to speak, become an American. She barely spoke English, but learned it quickly. And I came into the picture after she was married, maybe a year or two after she got to America. She got married to my father, Benjamin Gerstein, and I was born exactly 9 months later. So I remember my mother growing up extremely beautiful, almost movie star looks, although as a child you just took that for granted, but looking back at her pictures now, it's just stunning when you see her pictures. She was vivacious, but there was a side to her that her family saw, which was extremely anxious, fearful of danger, superstitious, controlling, intrusive, all these things. Sometimes I'd be talking on the phone with a friend and she'd be holding the phone. These weren't cell phones back then, so every phone was connected in the house. Her hand over the speaker listening in, sometimes listening through the door of my room, sometimes rifling through my drawers. Why? She wasn't intending to violate my privacy. She was trying to keep me safe, keep me away from danger. Danger was lurking everywhere. Sometimes we'd be in the car, my dad driving, and she was in the passenger seat, and the four of us were crammed in the back seat, and a hearse would go by, and she would immediately say a little incantation and make us say the same thing, Buchumsta, Buchumstas, Arabic, for 5 and 15 to ward off the evil eye. And then she would actually lick her finger and wipe it on your forehead, do it to all of us. She's very anxious, very, must have been something in her past that she never spoke about with me that made her so fearful of danger, something bad happening. I'll give you another example. My brother Mark, my youngest brother, he was home from college on a weekend, and it was a Sunday evening, it was getting dark out, and his friends came to pick him up, and he gave my mother a kiss goodbye and walked out the door, and he's walking to the car in the semi-darkness, and all of a sudden he said, I heard this piercing cry, Mark! And he said, my heart was pounding, and I turned around, I go, what? And my mother said, watch out! He said, watch out for what? He thought maybe a piano was going to fall on his head. She said, watch out for everything! This exemplified Dina, watch out for everything. Well, fast forward to the present moment. Last fall, Rick and I were attending a medical conference, and I got a call on my cell phone, and it was my mother. She had been having some health problems. She was going into pulmonary edema and CHF, and she was struggling with it, going to the doctor, getting put on various medications, attempting to get control over it, and I guess one day it got dramatically worse, and she had been in the hospital. I knew that she had been put in there, and she called me on the cell phone and said to me, I heard this change in her voice, she goes, Paul, I'm dying. Terrible, terrible fear, and she couldn't get a breath in, and I knew she was sick, and within a few days, she was over at Brigham and Women's in Boston, undergoing major cardiac surgery to replace three diseased heart valves. It was a life or death situation. She was extremely healthy, even at age 77 at the time. Very, very youthful. Remarkable. I mean, you look at her, you think she was in her 70s. So she underwent this surgery. But just before, I had an experience that where I saw my mother in a completely new light, something I had never quite seen before. I came up to her room the day of the surgery. It was in the morning. The surgery was planned for a few hours later. And I walked in the room, and she was lying in the hospital bed, and I took one look at her face, and I saw a look I had never seen. It was a look of fear, terror, someone confronting the possibility of death, the end of the self, the loss of your body, the loss of your friends, your family, everything you ever knew, all your memories, America, Morocco, the earth, the universe, all gone. And I saw that in her face, this terror. And it just totally melted my heart. I'd never quite seen that before. And then she went into surgery. We surrounded her bed before she went in. We were all crying. We were giving her kisses. And she said to us, I'll be back. And I kind of sensed she would. And she sailed through the surgery. Had a wonderful, wonderful, successful surgery. All the valves were replaced. And for 3 days, her energy started to come back, and she was obviously weak, but recovering, and we were able to come in and spend a lot of time with her at the Brigham and talk to her about her life, etc., etc. And then on the third day, she had a major stroke. Stroke was very severe. She probably could have died from it, but they were able to, because she was at the Brigham, in the middle of a Saturday night, bring her to a cath lab where they actually gave her a clot-busting drug directly into the blockage in the brain, and they limited the size of the stroke, but she ended up with very significant aphasia, unable to speak, and at first even to understand words. The only words that could come out were what is called limbic speech, which is probably created and processed in a part of the brain very different than the part that she lost, which was the left hemisphere along the motor strip. There's a speech area. And limbic speech, which is speech that involves deep emotion, including endearment, expressions of tenderness, anger, and also singing and swearing, that is preserved in this kind of stroke. That comes from some deeper part of the brain and probably the other side of the brain, the right side, the more intuitive side of the brain. So she was able to only really understand and speak that and gradually regain some of the other kind of speech, but never in any complex way. Well, it was a horrible, horrible moment for all of us. I remember being in the hospital room after the stroke, coming in the next day, and my stepfather and my brothers and later my sister came out saying to me, she never would have wanted this, Paul. I think we made a mistake. Oh, if she just hadn't gone through the surgery, she wouldn't have had the stroke, and I know she never would have wanted this. And they were right. She never would have wanted this. But I said this. I said, we can only see her state, her condition, from the outside, how it looks to us. We don't know it from the inside. It might be very different. And in my mind, I continued, I feel that everything would have been worthwhile if she finally makes it home and just is happy to be alive. To me, that's enough. And that actually happened. It was a long haul, rehab, back and forth to a rehab hospital near here, and eventually, finally, she made it home to South Hadley, right around January 1st. And she didn't cooperate with therapy. She didn't want it. She didn't feel hungry very much, and she started losing weight. And we just plied her. Dina, you have to eat. You have to, trying to force food and trying to get her to get up and walk. When she said, no, I don't want it. I don't want it, she'd say in a very emphatic way. Finally, we started to let go a little bit and just let her be what she was at that moment. Somehow, we thought she was depressed, but she wasn't. She was just knowing that she had lost something critical and would never get it back, and that it was time to just be who she was in the present moment. Perhaps she knew she didn't have much time left. People often know that. We were hoping against hope, and we were seeing her as she used to be and trying to get her back to that state. So we started to back off, and everything got so much better. I remember going in to visit her as much as I could. Coming in, she'd be lying on the recliner, and my whole relationship with her, which previously had been so difficult, so full of anxiety and stress, and her worrying about me, trying to control me and make sure I didn't come to harm, and my wishing she could be more intimate and let me fly and help me become a full adult human being, and all the misgivings about that, and all of that just melted away because we couldn't talk about that. All we could say is, I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. Over and over. With kisses. Kisses. Blowing kisses. Kisses on the cheek. Smiles. I love you. I love you. I love you. Day after day, week after week, month after month, everything had changed. It all melted away. It was so healing. I'm so grateful. What a strange thing to say. Well, 4 days ago, I went to her house again, thinking this would be another hello, and I would go about my day. And I went in, and she made eye contact with me and gave me this beautiful smile that she had already always given me, you know, since the stroke. I love you, I love you. And then closed her eyes and never came out again. And I knew something was different. And basically, she was ready. I spent 12 hours at her side, hour after hour, gradually becoming absolutely convinced that this was her last day on earth. Watching her slip away, take her last breath, face went white, and she was gone, and the body was just a shell. It wasn't her at all. Very, very mysterious, so mysterious. So, my stepfather, who loves Dina dearly, they were married for 42 years. My father died when I was 17. They got married 2 years after that and built a life together, had seven of us, three stepchildren and three, and he had three children and my mother had four children. All of our names were the same. It was almost like written in the stars. My middle name was Stuart. My brother's name was Stuart. My brother's name is Rick. His name was Rich. My sister's name is Joyce. Her name was Joyce. It was incredible. One in a million. And they shared this life together. They loved each other very, very much. And he came up to me and said, and this went on even before when she had her stroke, but more so after she died. We were all together. He was crying. Paul, I never planned for this. I never planned for this. He said this over and over again. Paul, I never planned for this. Kind of his way of saying, why me? And after having watched this process that I had seen many times as a doctor, but never so intimately, never with this vigil like It was like 12 hours of the most intense zazen, moment by moment. I said to him, "Bernie, no one can plan for a mystery. I should go back just a little bit and mention something else that's interesting in the context of this koan we're going to take up. When Bernie and Dina got married, the rabbi that married them was Rabbi Kushner. This was before he became famous. He later became famous for having written a book that was in very wide circulation, a bestseller, and the book was called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Isn't that ironic? When bad things happen to good people. So let's take up this koan because it speaks to this, to my mother's fear of something terrible happening and trying so hard to prevent that from happening, and all the difficulty that created for her and for us, and et cetera, till she finally was able to embrace herself. Her horrible situation, exactly as it is. And my stepfather's difficulties, and all of our difficulties, everyone in this room, when bad things happen to good people, why? Now, people often, in situations like this, turn to religion. They're uniquely drawn to it. Our intellectual mind can't explain this, can't say why, can't tell you what to do, can't deal, can't cope, it can't figure it out. It's a mystery. So we turn to religion. And some religions create a happy ending, so to speak, a heaven. Oh, mom went to heaven and someday I'll go to heaven and we'll all be reunited. Things like that. Judaism actually doesn't really do that. I sat down with a rabbi who had knocked on my stepfather's door a couple of days ago. This is before the funeral, after my mother died, the morning after actually. My brother Rick spent the night with my stepfather. I came in the morning to replace him, and there was a tap on the door after Rick left, and this old rabbi who was a neighbor walked in. His name was Rabbi Lander. He was stooped over, he had gray hair, wearing a yarmulke, had a fine tremor, he had Parkinson's disease. So he shook my hand very warmly, "I'm so sorry for your loss." And we sat down on the couch and had a little chat. And during this chat, I asked him, "How did you become a rabbi? What drew you to this?" He said, "Well, you know, it's funny, because all three of my brothers became doctors. I was the only one that became a rabbi." And he said it in a funny way, almost like his parents were disappointed, his Jewish parents. You know the Jewish stand on abortion, a fetus isn't viable till it graduates medical school? I think it's along those lines. But he had to, and he told me why. He said, "Paul, I was alive. I was actually living in Canada." He was lucky. His family, I think, was from Germany. He said, "I was alive during the Holocaust, and I could never wrap my arms around it. I could never comprehend it. I could never understand it. Here we are again when bad things happen to good people. And it drew me to religion. And I wanted to find out deeply what the answer to this question is. How could this happen? What did it mean?" He actually became a world expert on the Holocaust and was a professor at Hampshire College. He's now retired. But he said to me, "Paul," he said, "the Jewish religion's view is this. You come into the world with nothing, and you leave the world with nothing." And he added, "Except for your name. Except for your name." said that he had studied other religions as well, but and he had actually studied Zazen. He trained in Zazen. I was very amazed. He was a student of Tai Unos for a while. But this nothing. So Judaism has a little different slant on it. Now, let me read this koan to you. So this is the 97th koan from the Hekigan Roku. And we're going to, you know, don't immediately latch on to the words. Just hold it all lightly and zoom out and see its big picture. So the title of this koan is The Diamond Sutra and Being Reviled. And this is actually directly out of the Diamond Sutra. And as you know, the Diamond Sutra is the fundamental text of Zen Buddhism, the fundamental sort of root text, the text, a line of which was heard by the sixth patriarch and he became enlightened, which many masters have said, if you want to go all the way through to the very end of Zen Buddhism, then you must have the Diamond Sutra in your heart. So here's the koan. The Diamond Sutra says, one who is scornfully reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes which doom him to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out. Now in the actual Diamond Sutra, if you read this, there's a line that isn't in this koan, it's just before it. The Buddha actually said, when good women and good men who have adopted in their heart this text, the Diamond Sutra, and the Dharma, are reviled scornfully by others. That's how it starts, when good men and good women. This is about all of us. Why did they say scornfully reviled? It's interesting. In human experience, probably of all the terrible things that can befall human beings, and there are countless ones, probably the most, one of the most painful is to be scornfully reviled, to be rejected. They talk about the stress meter. One of the things that pins it is job loss, being fired, or a divorce. Those are so painful. In the Amish tradition, what you do with someone who has violated a very severe precept is you shun them, and that is more painful than anything else you can do to that person. Think about teenage angst. Rejection by your girlfriend, your boyfriend, loneliness, your friends laugh at you. What's happening now with this Twitter bashing, people getting bashed on social media by hundreds of people, thousands of people, suicides in teenagers who have been bashed on Facebook. Slut shaming, that's a new thing that people are doing now, slut shaming. All these things that are so exquisitely painful. We probably, I can presume, in this room, have all experienced something like that at some point in our life, and we know how painful it is. And it's interesting, we can do that to ourselves too. It's called shame. Such a difficult, painful, poisonous, deadening emotion, shame. So hard to get beyond that. So how does this koan help us? Because on the surface it does sound a bit like the Old Testament, doesn't it? An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You do something bad, what goes around comes around, you're going to get it. Let me read it one more time. The Diamond Sutra says, One who is reviled by others has done wicked acts in former lifetimes, which doom him to fall into evil worlds. But because of the scorn and vilification by others in the present life, the transgressions in the former life are wiped out. What does that mean? Wiped out. How are they wiped out? Why does it say here that you're doomed and that your transgressions are wiped out? What is going on here? One who is reviled by one who suffers a stroke, one who gets fired from their job, one who loses their wife, one who gets divorced, one who loses their money in the stock market. All these calamities. This is the human condition. No one can escape it. Rabbi Kushner wrote a whole book on it. Why did these things happen? Why? Very simply, because one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. It's called cause and effect. It's a chain of cause and effect. Goes all the way back. It goes back actually to the very beginning of the universe, to what theoretical physicists called the singularity, where everything was one thing and then spread out in a big explosion called the Big Bang. And that's when, as far as we know, all the scientific natural laws were created. And the universe, just like a Swiss watch, goes according to natural law. There's no escaping it. One thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. How could it be otherwise? Now, who is this one, and who are these others? That's the real hook in this koan. Who is this one, and who are these others? What's this present life, and what's the past life, and what is all this stuff? What happens when you really get this all the way down to the bottom, that it couldn't have been any other way? You don't even have to know why. You don't even have to believe in karma. You could just wake up after an anesthesia where everything got wiped out. After a big stroke, all your memories are gone. And you wake up to just this. It can't be other than just this. It is just this. It's already just this. Remember what I said last night? I quoted that Zen master. He said, there's nothing in particular to realize. There's nothing in particular to realize. Now, you know how people, when bad things happen, and that's called everyone, that's called the human condition, when they seek religion, they seek relief from these bad things. I want something to liberate me. It's no different in Zen. We come to this practice from pain, from suffering. We want to understand the world better. We want to understand why Holocaust happened, why people rejected me, why I have the shame inside, all these things. How can I get free of it? How can I liberate myself? We practice in order to get rid of these things, to enter some perfect place. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, no color, sound, smell, taste, touch. No pain, no cause of pain, no end of pain, all the rest of it. We have an idea of what that is. But this koan says otherwise. So what I said last night is, there's nothing in particular to realize, just get rid of the notion of Buddhas and sentient beings. And while you're at it, get rid of the ideas of I like this and I don't like this, or I want this and I don't want this, or this is good and that is bad. I said, do you hear the rain on the roof there? Now, it's okay. You may like rain or not like rain, but if you like it, it's still rain on the roof. If you don't like it, it's still rain on the roof. This is just this. Just this. It had a reason for being exactly this way. And at the very moment I know it, at the very moment I see it, it can't be taken back. It's done. It's completed. All your transgressions are wiped out in that moment. Wiped out. The moment you get that, it's done. Complete. I may like it, but it's done. I may not like it, but it's done. So when I sit down to Zazen, I start there. That's my starting point. I start where the world is done. I start where all the transgressions of the former life are, in quotes, wiped out. How are they wiped out? Because I've wrapped my arms around them. Now, if you read the Hekigan Roku, the actual source text, and it has been translated by the Cleary brothers, and it's really wonderful. In this text, there are some notes by Secho. He wrote some notes, and when you get to the point where it says, has done wicked acts in former lifetimes, and there's a little footnote, and you go down to Secho's little footnote, maybe he wrote in the margins. He wrote these words. He said, ass loads, horse loads. Kind of the modern day term would be shit loads. Shit loads of wicked acts that we've all done. You've heard that very simple description of Zen practice by this master. He said, practice good, avoid evil, keep the heart mind pure. What is good? What is evil? What are these wicked acts? Just simply making a dividing line. Just making something outside you. That is the source of what you might, with big quotes around it, call evil. Othering, outside. Let me read you one thing. We're going to finish with this. Now, this Hekigan Roku, the compiler, was actually the person who wrote this rather short piece. I'm going to read the whole thing. And his name was Yuan Wu, or in Japanese, Engo. So he was the compiler. He was the one who had a painting on the wall of Blue Cliffs while he was compiling all his koan and named the book The Blue Cliff Record. So I'm going to read this. This is from a book called Zen Letters. So he wrote this letter, I suppose, to one of his students, and the title of it is The Original Person. The great teaching is basically quite ordinary. It is easy to enter for those with sharp faculties and quick wits and broad penetration, who don't use their intellectual brilliance to try to comprehend it. The usual problem is, if you are overloaded with conditioned knowledge and arbitrary views, then when you try to approach this source, the more you delve into it, the farther away you get, and you are completely unable to penetrate through. Paul, I never planned for this. If you are equanimous towards everything, including the ultimate ungraspability of mind itself, and your conditioned mind fades away and spontaneously comes to an end, then the perfect illumination of inherent nature appears whole without needing any contrived efforts to make it. You cut off the flow and experience profound realization. When you neither go too far nor fail to go far enough, then you arrive at the naturally real working essence of the mind. This is what is meant by the saying, set to work on mind and the matter is decided. If you always let this naturally real essence appear amidst your daily activities, then how can you not be settled and secure? When the ancients awakened to mind, they awakened to this mind. When they activated its working potential, they activated this working potential. They were able to stay free and at ease for 10,000 generations without changing. They stood forth transcendent, in independent realization, and no longer placed themselves in opposition to anything. If you are in opposition to anything, then this creates duality. This is the key right here. If you are in opposition to anything, then this creates duality. Then you are stuck with self and others and gain and loss, and you are unable to walk upon the ground of reality. If you take a step further from this opposition, which you need to do every time you sit down on the cushion, you just start zazen. Assloads, horseloads, shitloads of wicked acts. Of course it's like this. It's done. If you take a step further, not a single thing is established in your mind as a picture that you wrestle with and blame yourself and blame others. After that, you are quiet and properly attuned, and you clearly see the original person. You get rid of all the concerns in your breast and the mental moment that's before your eyes, so that your whole being is liberated and at peace. The mental moment of hashing over what someone said to you, what I did, why I deserve, why I don't deserve. You are forever beyond any possibility of retreating or regressing. You attain fearlessness, and with expedient means based on this fearlessness, you can rescue sentient beings. You must continue this way without interruption forever. This is the best. And we'll end there today.